Jones versus Phillips, Noah J. Nelson, Appellant's Counsel, Scott D. Stovall, W. Henry M. Jones, Appellee's Counsel. Mr. Nelson, can you hear me?
I can, Madam Clerk. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Jones, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Chief Justice Lemons, were you able to hear me and both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Goodwin, were you able to hear me and both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Mims, were you able to hear me and both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Powell, were you able to hear me and both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Kelsey, were you able to hear me and both counsel?
Yes.
Justice McCullough, were you able to hear me and both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Chaffin, were you able to hear me and both counsel?
Yes.
Mr. Chief Justice, the parties are present and ready to begin.
All right. Mr. Nelson, you may begin.
Yes, sir. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Noah Nelson. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Andrea Gail Jones. First, I'd like to thank the court for the accommodations that it's made in these unique times to allow us to argue before it today. I would like to ask the court to reserve 3 minutes for a rebuttal.
All right.
I would also like to note that the current statute is now numbered as 55.1-136, but I will continue to refer to the tenants by the entirety statute as the previously numbered 55-20.2, as that's what all the briefs refer to it as. This court should reverse the disposition of the trial court that the proceeds, including the $7,115,513.92 already paid out under an insurance contract, are proceeds as contemplated by Section 55-20.2 and therefore immune from the creditors of Mr. Phillips. As it properly did in the Pitt decision, this court should defer this question to the legislature to weigh the competing public policy issues connected therewith and pass the law best suited to address those different interests. The court allowed two assignments of error in the present case, and either assignment provides the necessary basis to overturn the trial court's decision. The first assignment noted the misapplication of Section 55-20.2 by the trial court. The second assignment noted the ability of the court to dispose of this case by using contract law. The two errors track the two ways this case can unfold. Either the proceeds represent a conversion of the real property, or the proceeds come from an insurance contract executed between Chubb and Mr. Phillips. You may hear me refer to each as the conversion or the contract. Looking at the second assignment of error first, this court in Thompson v. Gerhart wrote that a contract of insurance is a personal contract and that the amount paid does not represent the proceeds of the property. Further, the court ruled that monies from an insurance contract paid to the life tenant who took out the fire insurance policy were the life tenant's property and that the remainder men had no right to those monies. Presently, the trust of the Phillips owned the residence. Neither trust is named in the policy. In fact, the record shows that the contract is between Chubb and Mr. Phillips. Therefore, in order to obtain tenants by the entirety protection, the Phillips must qualify under Section 55-20.2. Now, it appears that the trial court subscribed to the conversion theory in spite of the Phillips trusts retaining fee simple absolute in the property. The trial court wrote that it was the disposition of the property that inured the TBIE protection to the proceeds of the insurance contract. Neither statute nor case law support this interpretation. Had the proceeds of the policy been paid to the trust and the policy been in the name of the trust, then there could be more merit to this argument. The rule from the Oliver case is that the proceeds derived from a voluntary sale of real estate held by the entireties shall receive TBIE immunity. Pitts applied the rule from Oliver to immunize the notes in question, finding them to be the proceeds from a voluntary sale of real estate. The Pitts court also refused to extend TBIE protections to proceeds from an insurance policy specifically, instead leaving the choice between competing public policy interests to the General Assembly. After Pitt, in 1999, the Assembly formally recognized the right of tenants by the entirety in personalty via statute, which after an amendment in 2001, more or less became the statute we know today as previously numbered 55-20.2. Now, the mechanics of the statute are important. Subsection A allows for broad applications of tenants by the entirety to personal deed. Still, it requires a manifestation of intent by the husband and wife. The assembly could have employed shall instead of may, or said all property owned by a husband and wife shall be treated as tenants by the entirety, but it did not. Section C of the statute begins that with any property of a husband and wife that is held by them as tenants by the entirety and conveyed to their trust. And this is important because you can note that the property must already be held by the husband and wife as tenants by the entirety, thereby qualifying under subsection A to qualify for protection under subsection C. Subsection C continues, and any proceeds of the sale or disposition of such property. The phrase is key because it is nearly unchanged from the rule in Oliver that was subsequently applied in Pitts. In Pitts, at page 905 of the decision, the court explicitly categorized separately, apart from a voluntary sale, proceeds from judicial sales, the surplus remaining after foreclosure, and most importantly, payments of insurance claims, and left the General Assembly to choose among competing public policy interests, which it has not yet done. Now, contrast this with the actions of the court and the General Assembly in Ligon v. County of Goochland, where this court found that the statute in question did not allow a waiver of sovereign immunity because the statute lacked sufficient language to provide that that an explicit waiver was available. After the decision in the following legislative session, the Assembly clarified this in writing by stating, this paragraph shall constitute a waiver of sovereign immunity. Now, it's important to remember that insurance proceeds are not by default held tenants by the entirety. The Assembly's use of may instead of an alternate construction indicates the manifestation of intent is required. When the Assembly codified the case law, their wording of the statute provided more expansive coverage of the personal property that could be held as TBIE, not merely the proceeds from the sale of real property. Still, the increased breadth does not solve the issue that the Pitts Court brought to the Assembly's attention. When an involuntary conversion occurs, are the proceeds also held as tenants by the entirety? As such, this court must determine whether the Phillips manifested an intent to hold the proceeds of the insurance contract between Mr. Phillips and Chubb as tenants by the entirety. And now to get there, we have to examine the intent aspect of the statute. Intent can either be explicit or implied. In examining the explicit aspect of this, it's worth noting that the Phillips took the time and expense, as shown in the record, to draft an agreement to hold all their tangible personal property as tenants by the entirety. Why then did they not include the intangible personal property like contractual rights in this agreement? It's also worth noting that no evidence was presented at trial of any steps taken by the Phillips to explicitly show their intent to hold the insurance contract entered into by Mr. Phillips as tenants by the entirety. This court, from its review of the trial court transcript, is already aware of the timeline of the garnishment filing, the emails between Mr. Phillips and Chubb, how Mrs. Phillips' name came to be on those emails, as well as the checks. The Phillips point to the checks as evidence of intent, yet the checks name only Mr. Phillips as the insured and only Mr. Phillips as the claimant. The only apparent reason for the mention of Mrs. Phillips is the email sent by Mr. Phillips on March 1st, 2018, where Mr. Phillips asked that the monies be deposited into a joint account, the details of which are detailed in the email located in joint appendix at page 167. Where the money is going still is a post hoc agreement among the Phillips and the adjusters and is not evidence of intent on the part of Mr. Phillips when the insurance contract was entered into or at the time that it became operative. In analyzing the implied idea of intent, the Phillips rely on two cases in particular among many. The first is Allen v. Parkey, and the second is Kerr v. Dill. Now, in Allen v. Parkey, we know that we glean from that no mention of the marital relationship is necessary in order to understand that there's an implied that something can be held as tenants by the entirety. But if we look at the facts there, we see that the deed in that case said that it was between Anna Ellie of the one part and W.P. Allen and Mary Ellie Allen of the other part. There's also a subsequent clause in the deed describing survivorship, and that should the husband predecease the wife, all goes to the wife and vice versa. In Kerr v. Dill, which was decided by the Roanoke Circuit Court, the Kerrs completed two forms. On one, they checked a box entitled joint tenant WROS, with rights of survivorship. On one of the accounts, Joseph C. Kerr was listed as the account name. Pamela Kerr, wife as joint tenant, was the other name that was listed.
Counsel, may I interrupt for just a minute? This is Justice Kelsey. May I ask you this? Has the fire insurance company paid the proceeds of the policy payment to anyone?
They paid, Your Honor, they paid $7,115,513.92 already to the Phillips, to Mr. Phillips, and they're holding the amount of the garnishment currently and have yet to disperse that.
So the corpus of the garnishment action, the target of the garnishment action, is in the hands of the fire insurance company right now. Is that correct?
That's correct, Chubb Insurance.
Are they a party to this case?
They're the garnishee. This is an exemption claim, Your Honor.
So are they, in your opinion, an indispensable party or a non-indispensable party?
As it relates to this, the exemption claim, I do not think that they're, I think that they are a dispensable party, because this claim has to do with whether or not the proceeds of that policy are held as tenants by the entirety. The only function of the garnishee in this would be to hand over property that is the right of the judgment debtor.
But in the end of the case, if you win this, wouldn't you want a judge to issue an order saying to the fire insurance company, hand over the money?
That's correct. That would be the natural conclusion of the garnishment proceeding itself.
But the fire insurance company is not a party to this proceeding.
They're a party to the garnishment, which is the action under the umbrella under which this exemption claim was filed.
Okay, thank you.
So I think it's important to note some of the factual differences between Kirby Dill and Allen v. Parkey with what we have in front of us today. In our case, in the present case, you know, no application was entered into evidence at trial. Mrs. Phillips' name appears nowhere in the policy, and Mrs. Phillips, even the equivalent of Mrs. Phillips, is not named anywhere with any particularity. We can contrast that with Parkey and with Kerr, where both parties were named by name, and then in Kerr, where both parties were not only named by name, but also named with title husband or wife or joint tenant. It seems to me to be a long jump that the Phillips are asking the court to make, to not only assume an implied intent, but also to then, I'm sorry, to if they're going to ask the court to make that jump of implied intent, then at least the policy should name Mrs. Phillips with particularity. Now, there's also
Mr. Nelson, you have 2 minutes and 48 seconds left. You may use it any way you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, to rule in favor of the Phillips today, this court must decide first that both Mr. and Mrs. Phillips were parties to the insurance contract, and then that the intent for survivorship was somehow intended from the words of the policy, a policy that does not mention Mrs. Phillips by name. Alternatively, if the court is to adopt the reasoning of the trial court, this court must conclude that the legislature intended to extend tenants by the entirety protections to proceeds from insurance contracts, despite the lack of evidence of such a will through the words used. Thank you.
All right, you have 2 minutes and 6 seconds left for a rebuttal. Mr. Stovall?
Good morning, Your Honor. This is actually Henry Jones. I'll be presenting arguments on behalf of Kathy Sue Phillips and Terry Phillips this morning.
All right.
May it please the court, Your Honor. Thank you all for hearing us over phone today. We really appreciate it. So on behalf of all the litigants, I thank you. The issue in this case can be boiled down to whether the insurance proceeds from an insurance policy insuring a home that is in no dispute, the home is protected as a tenancy by the entirety, whether those insurance proceeds are also protected from a claim of only one of the spouse's creditors? And the answer to that question is going to be, yes, those proceeds are exempt from one of the spouse's creditors. Whether the court takes the route that the trial court took, which was that these were proceeds of a disposition of the property under 55-20.2 subsection C, or the policy itself was held personal property that was owned as tenants by the entirety, the answer is that these proceeds are exempt, and we would ask that this court affirm the trial court's ruling. And Judge, I will take this up in the order that the trial court took it up, that these insurance proceeds are proceeds of the disposition of the property. If we look at the plain language of 55-20.2 subsection C, it's broad in application. It says, and I'm quoting, "And any proceeds of the sale or disposition of such property shall have the same immunity from the claims of the separate creditors as if it had remained a tenancy by the entirety." It uses broad language, any proceeds. It doesn't specify only certain proceeds. It doesn't specify only insurance proceeds. It doesn't specify proceeds from an eminent domain taking or a leasehold or a full conveyance of the full fee simple interest in the property. It's any proceeds. In disposition, if we just take the plain language of the statute, disposition has been defined as the act or the power of disposing or disposing of or the state of being disposed of. If we apply that plain language and that definition to this statute and the facts at hand, this property was burned to the ground by a horrible involuntary conversion, by a fire of the property. It was disposed of by a fire. And any proceeds from the sale of that disposal of the residence would be protected under the plain language of the statute. If you look at the language as well, I think it's important to note that the legislature chose to use a disjunctive or when it wrote sale or disposition. Or is a function word and it indicates an alternative between different or unlike things. So while Ms. Jones has argued on brief that it only applies to full voluntary sales of the property, the use of the word or indicates that it's something different than a voluntary conveyance. Ms. Jones has made the argument on brief that sale or disposition can only mean sale, gift, or device of the property. But if we take that as true, then that reading would be illogical, redundant, and it wouldn't be in accordance with what the legislature actually intended. A gift by legal definition is a transfer without consideration. If there's no consideration, then there'd be no proceeds to protect. Likewise, a device is a transfer by will or a transfer by a trust, but not for consideration. And again, if there's no consideration, then there would be no proceeds, which leaves you with just a meaning of sale or sale, which makes no sense because it leads to a redundancy. And as this court's noted, we assume that the legislature gives independent meaning to all the words that it uses, and it doesn't use extra language just to be included willy-nilly. And I think it's important to note that other jurisdictions that have examined this issue have come to the same conclusion that we argue in the insurance proceeds context. And all of the jurisdictions that recognize the tenancy by the entirety in personal property, as Virginia does, have extended T-by-E protection to the insurance proceeds. Of note is the Cooper case. It's a 1955 case from Arkansas, which the trial court used to support its ruling that these proceeds were proceeds of a disposition of the property. And that was a case where an insurance policy was taken out solely in the name of the husband, but an insured T-by-E property, and the court ruled that the proceeds were part of the estate by the entirety. Also of note is every jurisdiction that has come down on the opposite side of our point of view are locations and jurisdictions where they do not recognize tenancy by the entirety in personal property. I think the two jurisdictions that we found were North Carolina and New York, both of which are jurisdictions that don't recognize TBIA ownership and personal property. So we believe that in terms of the first argument that the trial court took, that the trial court's ruling contained no error. It was supported by the record. Clearly, all the insurance money and all the evidence at trial was all of the funds taken and paid under this policy were paid to the Phillips. It was paid to Kathy Sue Phillips and Terry Phillips. And that was the evidence at trial. I think that any suggestion to the contrary is unsupported by the record. I know there was one exhibit, it was a cover letter, I believe, that listed Terry Phillips, or it was directed to him, but the check that was enclosed was made out to both of the spouses. So not only is this meet the plain language of the statute, but it also meets how the insurance company interpreted their own policy when they were determining and adjusting this claim. And to get to my second line of argument, that this is personal property owned as TBIE, we believe even though the trial court didn't go down this path and under the right result for the wrong reason doctrine, that the trial court would have been within its rights to uphold that this is personal property owned as TBIE. Opposing counsel makes the point that Ms. Phillips' name does not appear on the policy, but what has been left out is the fact that the policy states on its face, and I'm referring to JA 40, it says this is a contract between you and us, and it defines you on the same page, meaning the person named in the coverage summary and a spouse living with that person. Ms. Phillips, there's no dispute, there was no dispute below that Ms. Phillips is Mr. Phillips' spouse, that they resided at this property. So she is a party to this contract. She's bound by all of the obligations. I believe the record supported that she was included in the investigation of the claim. She obviously was listed as a payee on the checks that were issued by the insurance company. And she would be bound by all of any exclusions that may apply under the policy. Additionally, the policy included language for what happens in the event of death, and that's at JA 83, and it says in the event of your death, we'll cover your spouse. So there's language within the four corners of the insurance policy that say and dictate what happens in the event of one of the parties' deaths. Additionally, the argument put forth by the appellate would require this court and the trial court below to ignore the plain language of the policy, which is we will only pay up to your insurable interest in the property. Mr. Phillips is a trustee. He and Ms. Phillips are both co-trustees of their respective trusts. Mr. Phillips' trust owns 1% of the property, and Ms. Phillips' trust owns 99% of the interest in the property. This court's noted that a garnishment action is essentially an action on the claims of the garnishee. Mr. Phillips individually, if we push it to the appellate's point of view, would result in Mr. Phillips having no insurable interest in the property because he and his wife own it as trustees with his trust owning 1%. So there's really nothing for Ms. Jones to garnish because all of the proceeds are owed to them as trustees. And we believe that the case law from Oliver and Pitts support this point of view. I will mention that they've made the argument in regards to the Pitts opinion, which was issued in 1991, that this court chose not to extend it to insurance policies. And there, that was a certified question of state law, I believe from the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the court didn't come down one way or the other. It just said we are going to answer the question as certified, and it didn't say that insurance money was exempt or was not exempt. And I would like to note that in the Oliver opinion, Haufer cited to a bankruptcy case, I believe it is the Moore case, and they said their holding was in accord with Moore. And this court, that was noted. And the Moore case, it was a bankruptcy case in the Eastern District, I believe, was a claim for TBIE ownership and rent proceeds from TBIE properties. So it was property, I believe, that was leased out that was owned as TBIE. And that was found to be protected in that bankruptcy case. I'd like to address a couple of the arguments that have been made by the appellate in terms of whether it's a total disposition or sale or a total or partial disposition. They've argued that it's required to be a total conveyance of the bundle of sticks. Nowhere in the statute does it say this exemption only applies to a total conveyance or a total sale. It says, and any proceeds of the sale or disposition. In regards to the argument that they've asserted that there's a specific manifestation of intent required, we believe that that was not adequately addressed at the trial court level, and we would ask that the court not entertain that because the trial court did not have a chance to review it. We shouldn't be compelled to answer that on appeal.
You have 3 minutes and 7 seconds until your time runs out. It sounds like somebody's vacuuming their office back there. If you're the one, move your phone.
I apologize. I had you on speakerphone, and there's somebody mowing the grass or blowing leaves outside. Is this better?
Much better. Three minutes and 5 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. In regards to the appellate's argument that in order to claim the benefits under subsection C, you must qualify under subsection A, there's nowhere in subsection C that the legislature wrote, in order to claim these benefits, you must qualify under subsection A. And in fact, in this instance, it's been conceded that the property itself is owned as TBIE because it's been conveyed to their separate revocable trust, and they both continue to reside with each other. They are, I think, the only issue under that line of theory is whether this was a disposition of the property. And we would argue that it clearly is a disposition. It's supported by the evidence. It's supported by the insurance company paying over $7 million to both of the Phillips. It's supported by the plain language of the insurance policy, which says this is a contract between you and us, and you is defined as Mr. Phillips and his wife, Miss Phillips, who lives with him at the property. And we would ask that the trial court, we would ask that this court affirm the trial court's ruling. Or in the alternative, we would ask that the trial court, or that this court only reverse, if it is inclined to reverse, order that only 1% of the garnished proceeds be paid to Ms. Jones, if anything, because again, Mr. Phillips, this property is owned by the trust, and we would ask that this court not rewrite the insurance contract at issue to write Ms. Phillips out as a party. We would ask that this court not rewrite the statute in issue, to include language that the General Assembly did not include. And if there are no questions, then.
Counsel, all right, this is Jeff Kelsey again.
Go ahead.
Who are we supposed to be ordering to pay the money?
I believe that based on the order that was entered below, it was the order that's been appealed from stated that Chubb was to hold the money. Chubb is the garnishee in this issue or in this matter. Chubb made no appearances by counsel or otherwise.
So I think that in terms of if this court's inclined to affirm, it would just be an order to affirm.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I'm sorry if that did that answer the question?
Sort of.
All right, Mr. Nelson, you have 2 minutes and 6 seconds reserved for rebuttal. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I wanted to discuss the survivorship provision, or really the in case of death provision that counsel brought up in the policy. In reality, the purported survivorship provision is simply a statement of continued coverage for the spouse of the policyholder, their legal representative, or any person having temporary custody of, to quote, your property. Noteworthy here is the incongruity among the possessive adjectives used and the definition of you suggested by counsel for the Phillips. Your death, your spouse, etc., reach a nonsensical conclusion if we're to accept that the Phillips argument that you means the named insured and the spouse. Counsel also points to what other jurisdictions have done, and I would ask the court to do the same that it's done in Pitts, and be deferential to what the General Assembly says to do here. The General Assembly, that's the General Assembly's job, and in Pitts as here, the statute that, or the rule from Oliver, which is what is encapsulated in the statute, does not exceed or make explicit what all is covered. And I think that we've looked, when I started to review this, I had to look to see what does explicit mean at, when it looks from the legislature. And that's how I came upon the Ligon case. We saw from Ligon that when the legislature thinks that something explicitly needs to be said, they say it explicitly, not staying in the ambiguity that we have here. As it relates to the total dispositions, it does say any proceeds. I would note that it doesn't say all proceeds. And then as to the sufficiency of the insufficiency of manifestation of intent, I would note that in the brief of the Phillips, they quote me at trial speaking about this, and therefore I would think that it was sufficiently noted, not to mention that it's the wording of the statute. And finally, to address Justice Kelsey's question once again, I think that
your time has expired.
Thank you, Ron.
Your time has expired. The clerk will call the next case.